Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 241, and it is March 29th. Ooh, that really turned on. March 29th, and we have an announcement from your SI leader first.
Meet up with them on Wednesday and they can give it to you. The Thursday, I believe, is your test. We're going to play a game of Jeopardy right before your test, so you're more than welcome to come. It's just a good review right before the test. So you can all come, so that's all the reminders. Does anyone have any questions? No? All right.
No.
Yeah? Okay, thank you.
Okay, fantastic. And don't forget, SI has changed location. It's now an SEM 106, which is on this floor, just down the hall. Okay, really good. Yeah, so we do have the schedule on the board, and so today's the 29th, and we're going to start endocrinology today, so we're a little bit behind in lecture. Then we got spring break next week, so don't come to class next week, and then week right after spring break, Tuesday we have a lecture, and then Thursday is the exam. Okay, on the exam are chapters 9, 10, and 11. And I hope you all have a great spring break. I got to tell you what I'm doing. All right? Did I tell you guys what I'm doing yet? I did tell you. No, I didn't tell you. I have jury duty that week. Oh, no, don't say that. Go, yeah, do it. Do your civic duty. Be you too? Yeah, I got to go to Torrance. So, I might see you there. And you got to give me some good props. Go with a smile on your face and a clear mind and have fun, right? Do your civic duty. All right, so that also means what? If there's probably no chance I'll be impaneled on a jury. But if I am, I suppose there's a chance I won't be here on Tuesday the week after if it's a really long trial or something. All right, now that necessarily would not be good because we're probably going to finish up endocrinology on Tuesday, right after spring break. But if I'm not here, guess what? Then I'll give you some extra study assignments to make sure that you're ready for the exam. We won't postpone the exam. Even if I get on jury duty for the next 6 months, if it's a really long case, right? You still are going to finish the class and get a grade. So still keep coming to class. Okay. So if I'm not here, even on Thursday, we'll have a substitute to make sure that you can take the test. Okay, so I thought I would share that good news with you. All right, so we're going to start endocrine chapter today. We talked about nervous system. I think I'm going to go over here like this. So does anybody have a schedule? A question on the schedule at all? No, pretty straightforward, right? All right, so we're going to start the endocrine system. Endocrine system has some similarities with a system that we just finished up, and that is the nervous system. It's for integration and control of various functions inside your body. But there are some differences. Nervous system can transmit information very rapidly, in less than a second, from one part of your body to another. And it can institute control mechanisms in less than a second. So it's very fast, but the duration of that action is very short. It can only, for instance, to control a skeletal muscle, if you tell your biceps to contract, it's going to contract and it's going to start relaxing immediately unless you give it another voluntary command to contract once again. So the duration of action of the nervous system is very short, although it is fast. On the other hand, the endocrine system relies on signaling molecules, and they might take a little while to produce an effect in your body. But once they produce an effect, it will be longer lasting compared to the nervous system. So just compare and contrast the endocrine and nervous system in those two respects. Oh, I'm sure I had my cursor worked out. I guess not. All right, let's turn it back on. Arrow options visible. No, it should be visible. Should never go away. Okay, maybe it won't now. All right, so these are some of the things we're going to talk about. We're going to look at some mechanisms of hormone action as well as a number of endocrine glands, and we'll learn about some hormones that they secrete. And some of this is a review from anatomy. So, for instance, on this first slide right here, we see a bunch of endocrine glands in the body, and that includes the hypothalamus and the pituitary. We're going to look at two divisions of the pituitary. All right, so this is just a zoomed-in region. I see the diencephalon right here, nice pons and medulla right down over here. pituitary gland within the sphenoid bone, right? And then we have a thyroid gland. We also have parathyroid glands embedded in the thyroid gland. And then right on top of the kidneys, we have the adrenal gland, and in particular, the adrenal cortex we're going to look at in this chapter. The thymus gland is in the mediastinum, not shown on this diagram. And then the kidneys are also an endocrine gland, which we're going to talk about, I think, when we get to the kidney chapter, maybe not so much in this chapter. And then testes and ovaries. All right, so what the heck is an endocrine gland? You know of two major classes of glands in your body. What are they? Exocrine and endocrine. Endocrine is one class. All right, so what's the difference between an exocrine and an endocrine gland? There is a structural difference, right? And you just mentioned that very nicely. An exocrine gland produces a product that's secreted into a duct. An endocrine gland, on the other hand, produces a product, a signaling molecule, that does not get secreted into the duct, but is just secreted into the extracellular space, and then it diffuses into the circulatory system. And then when it's in the circulatory system, where does it go? Everywhere in the body. And here is something else that's important, and that is, does that product then, since it's going everywhere in your body, does it affect everything in your body, or only selective places? And why? Only selective places, because, and we call those target tissues or targets, because what does a target tissue have to have in order to be a target? It's got to have to, has to have a receptor for that particular hormone, which matches in shape. It's got to be complementary in shape to the hormone. So the hormone is the ligand in that particular case, and the receptor is going to be complementary in shape to it. So, and they have to bind together in order to produce some kind of response. Okay, so endocrine glands are ductless glands. They secrete hormones into the bloodstream. So a hormone is a chemical messenger secreted by an endocrine gland. Hormones go to target cells that contain specific receptors for it. And some hormones are secreted by endocrine tissues like the anterior pituitary, but there are also neurons that secrete signaling compounds that get picked up by the circulatory system. And if a signaling compound of that nature gets secreted by a neuron, then it acts like a hormone, but it's also acting like a neurotransmitter, so it doesn't nice and neatly fit into any one category. So we combine these concepts together and call it a neurohormone. So for instance, the hormones secreted by the hypothalamus, which is a part of the central nervous system, are what we consider neurohormones if they're picked up by the circulatory system and delivered through the body, like oxytocin and ADH, which we're going to talk about. And then hormones affect metabolism of the target cells. And we're going to see how some mechanisms change. So by maybe activating enzymes or producing other proteins, maybe turning transcription on inside the nucleus, various different ways that it can do that. So here's a list, a nice table that shows some major hormones and what glands they secrete. And I'm certainly not going to go through this particular table right here, but I think there is a very important theme in this class, and that is a theme of antagonism. So what's your impression of an antagonism? Good thing to have or bad thing to have? Very good thing, right? Because it produces balance and control, precise control in your body. So some of these hormones are antagonistic to each other, and I want to point a couple of these out. Okay, within the pancreas, there are certain little islands of groups of cells that we call the islets of Langerhans. And the pancreas produces two hormones, insulin and glucagon, right? And these two hormones are, in the simplest sense, right, antagonistic to each other because insulin, they have a number of different effects, but in this one effect that I just called simple, which might not be so simple, but the one way that I'm thinking about it is that insulin decreases blood glucose concentration. And then glucagon is going to be antagonistic to it, which then does what? Raises blood glucose concentration, right? So these two working in opposition to each other means that, generally speaking, if somebody's healthy in terms of glucose metabolism, they can precisely control and regulate their blood glucose levels, irrespective of whether they're in a fasting state or a fed state. Glucose concentration in the blood will stay the same. So that's one good example of two hormones that are antagonistic to each other. Another good example has to do with blood levels of calcium. How it is regulated? It's regulated by two hormones, the parathyroid glands within the thyroid gland, right? So you create parathyroid hormone, and parathyroid hormone increases blood calcium concentration. There are a number of mechanisms that it does that. One way is by demineralizing bone, because bone is a reservoir for calcium, but it also helps increase absorption from your diet. But nonetheless, the effect is what? Increasing blood calcium levels. And then there are some other cells embedded or part of the thyroid gland that secrete calcitonin, which have an opposite effect, okay, compared to parathyroid hormone. So the balance of those two hormones then helps maintain the proper level of calcium in your blood. For what kinds of purposes have we seen so far in this class? We looked at one really important reason for calcium. Yeah, for, in particular, really close, I was thinking more like synaptic transmission, right? So transmission of information across the synapse, because calcium is necessary for binding of those synaptic vesicles within the presynaptic futon. Okay. So let's dive into that list a little bit, talk about some of these different hormones, and we're going to classify them as to their particular chemical characteristics. Some are amine hormones. What the heck does that mean? Amine. It has amino group. Can you picture in your mind what an amino group is? That NH2 group? Okay. Which kind of makes it hydrophilic, which means that these have a tendency to dissolve in water. Right? And all of these hormones are derived from tyrosine and tryptophan. These are amino acids. But more importantly, what kind of amino acids are these things? Okay, these both are essential amino acids, right? So typically, if you only eat plant proteins, you're going to be deficient in the concentrations of these amino acids, right? So only animal proteins contain these in sufficient quantity to make all of these different hormones right here, like norepinephrine, epinephrine, thyroxine, and melatonin. Okay, but I noticed one right here, thyroxine requires more than just amino acids to make it up. It also needs some inorganic elements, namely iodine. All right, so I don't want to lead you astray by just telling you that these are just amino acid hormones. They require other things, or some of them do. Okay, some could be polypeptide proteins. Some good examples of this would be insulin and glucagon, as well as some others like oxytocin from the posterior pituitary, antidiuretic hormone from the posterior pituitary, growth hormone, adrenal corticotropic hormone, and parathyroid hormone. So these are going to be proteins or very short polypeptide hormones. Some are modified proteins, modified because they've been conjugated with a sugar molecule. So that just means that a sugar molecule has been joined to a polypeptide, and these would be LH and FSH for control of the reproductive system, and thyroid stimulating hormone. That's a trophic hormone that goes from the anterior pituitary to the thyroid gland to stimulate the thyroid gland. And then another important class of hormones are what we call steroids, right? And they're all derived from cholesterol. So cholesterol is the basic molecule that you have to have in your body to make testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, and cortisol, for instance. All right, and what else could you tell me about estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, and cortisol? Because they're based on, these are steroids based on cholesterol. What else do you know about the physical chemistry of these particular hormones? Yeah, they're hydrophobic, right? They're lipid molecules, so they're going to have different kinds of actions in our body compared to other kinds of hormones. Okay, and there's probably some, if you're taking exogenous hormones, we've got to be really careful with that, I suppose. But if it's a lipid hormone, it's probably a lot easier to overdose on lipid kinds of hormones. Like, it's easy to overdose on lipid forms of vitamins that you're taking because your body has a tendency to store them, right? If it's a water-soluble hormone, then it's easily disposed of in your body through kidneys. Every time you urinate, you'll be excreting things. That's why vitamin C, for instance, is really non-toxic because you can't build up a sufficient concentration to be toxic. All right, so let's continue thinking about these steroid hormones. We said that the precursor molecule is cholesterol, and then with some minor rearrangements, cholesterol can be converted into progesterone, And females have progesterone, but males do not, even though that's the first step in this process. In the male, it's quickly converted, okay, into testosterone via another intermediate right here. I'm not so concerned that you know these different intermediates in this pathway. But cholesterol gets converted into progesterone, and then progesterone has a couple different fates in the adrenal cortex. It can be converted into cortisol, all right? And progesterone in the testes or ovaries is converted into testosterone. So even ovaries do produce testosterone, but then in an ovary, it quickly gets converted to estrogen, all right? So estrogen is like the end line product in the ovaries of cholesterol. And testosterone and estrogen are the male-female analogs of each other. They produce secondary sex characteristics in males and females, respectively. All right, and these are all based on having proper levels of cholesterol in your body. Thyroid hormones are also lipids because of how amino acids are put together to make a thyroid hormone. And there are two forms that I see on this slide. One form of thyroxine, okay, has four iodine molecules on it, right? That gives it activity. We call that T4 or tetraiodothreonine. And that's secreted by the thyroid gland. The thyroid gland also secretes triiodothreonine. And triiodothreonine is actually a little bit more active compared to T4. All right, so when T4 enters a cell, a target cell, it gets converted to T3 where it performs its activity. So these can diffuse into target tissues. All right, so where do you think might there be a receptor for these thyroid hormones and for all the other steroid hormones? Since they can enter the cell, do they need to have a receptor on the plasma membrane, for instance? No, because they can pass right through the plasma membrane. There are some exceptions to that rule, but the receptors for hydrophobic hormones are intracellular. Receptors for hydrophilic hormones are extracellular on the plasma membrane. Okay, some common aspects. Both the nervous system and endocrine system use chemicals to communicate. For instance, what's the chemical that's used in the nervous system? Neurotransmitter, right? And the endocrine system is called a hormone. The difference between neurotransmitters and hormones is transport in the blood for which one? Transport in the blood for hormones. Neurotransmitters are transported by diffusion across the synaptic cleft, very short distance. Some chemicals are used as hormones and neurotransmitters, and probably you should have on the tip of your tongue an example of that. Okay, how about norepinephrine? Can it be used as a neurotransmitter? Yes, it can. Okay, but it can also be used as a hormone. In what particular case? Part of the autonomic nervous system. What endocrine gland secretes norepinephrine directly into the blood? The adrenal medulla gland, right? So go back and look at the autonomic nervous system. All right, targets for both neurotransmitters and hormones must have specific receptor proteins that are complementary in shape to that particular ligand, whether it's a neurotransmitter or a hormone. And there must be some way to rapidly inactivate both of them. All right, so for instance, if it's a neurotransmitter in the neuromuscular junction, which would be acetylcholine, right? Once a somatic motor neuron releases acetylcholine, say on the biceps brachii, you don't want the biceps brachii to contract for the rest of your life, right? You want it to be able to relax. So there's got to be a way to then get rid of that signal, the acetylcholine signal, so that that muscle can relax again. And does anybody know how to get rid of acetylcholine in a synapse or a neuromuscular junction? I think we talked about it. It's called acetylcholinesterase, right, reduces the activity of acetylcholine. Okay, so hormone interactions. We talked about this just a little bit. All right, a tissue usually responds to a number of different hormones, and how would you explain that to somebody? How can a tissue respond to a number of different hormones? Because if that particular tissue has a number of different receptors, then it's going to be sensitive to a number of different kinds of signaling molecules. Right? And let's just say that we have a target tissue, and it has two different kinds of receptors to bind two different hormones at the same time. We can consider what the effects of those different hormones are. They'll be synergistic if they work together to produce an effect. All right? But the effect should be a little bit different than just adding the two effects individually together. Right? So the effect should be greater when both receptors have ligands bind to them, okay, compared to what the effect would be if one plus the other receptor had a ligand bind to it. So there's some synergism. So if the effect for receptor A was 2 and the effect produced by receptor B was 2, if both A and B bound ligands, the effect would not be 4, but would be 8 or 10 or 15 or some greater number. All right, that's what synergism really means. All right, a hormone can have a permissive effect if it enhances or allows the effect of a target organ to a second hormone, then it has a permissive effect. We don't really call that synergistic. It just allows that effect to take place on a target tissue. And then this last one we talked about already, and that is if one hormone inhibits the effect of another, then it is antagonistic to the first hormone. And we gave you a couple examples of those. All right, let's look at some mechanisms. So you could think of mechanisms pretty much like an enzyme. Okay, their target cells show specificity, which means that if a signaling molecule is going to bind to a receptor, it has to have just the right shape. So any molecule with just the right shape to bind to that active site, right, on the receptor is going to produce some kind of effect. And because the shapes of the ligand and the receptor are so specific, that produces high affinity. So that just means that very low concentrations of enzyme will bind to a receptor because the shape, the fit is just so perfect. So very little hormone is necessary to produce an effect. And since there's such high affinity, a target tissue does not have to have a lot of receptor sites to produce an effect. So that just means that there's low capacity for a hormone. That just means that very, very low concentrations of hormone are necessary, and when it binds to receptors in your body, then that hormone pretty much disappears in your circulatory system. Okay, lipophilic hormones or hydrophobic hormones have receptors in the target cytoplasm or maybe inside the nucleus of the cell because these molecules can diffuse through the plasma membrane. All right, and irregardless of where the receptors are in the cytoplasm or the nucleus, right, they have an effect on transcription. They're eventually going to have their effect on the nucleus inside the cell. And we call that the genomic action of a particular hormone. All right, so what's the job of the nucleus? It stores DNA. Yeah, and what's like a building block of DNA that has an effect on our cells? Okay. I'm thinking of a gene, okay? So DNA is made up of genes, and what does a gene do for us? A gene can produce something. It can produce proteins, okay? So when a lipophilic hormone binds to receptors inside the cell, it's going to have an effect on protein synthesis because it's going to activate protein synthesis by making these genes become active, all right? And what are the two steps in protein synthesis called? Yeah, translation and transcription, I like that. And one comes before the other. Which one is first? Which one has to happen first? Transcription, right? And transcription is making RNA from DNA. That's got to come first. Where does that happen? Inside the nucleus, right? So when these hormones are released or picked up by receptors inside the cell, they are what we call transcription factors. They initiate transcription, which is the first step of protein synthesis, right? So they're going to change the kinds of proteins that cell makes, right? And those proteins could be enzymes, for instance, which then will change metabolism inside the cell. Right? We call that the genomic action. But as you can imagine, if you have to stop everything you're doing and make a protein, that's not something that's going to happen at a snap of a finger, right? That's going to take some time. So that takes at least 30 minutes to do that. That particular kind of control mechanism wouldn't work, for instance, if you want to contract your biceps brachii to grab a glass to take a drink of water, right? We'd never be able to finish our day if it took 30 minutes to do that. So that's a big difference between the nervous system and endocrine system. Receptors for water-soluble molecules, on the other hand, right, are on the surface of the target cell. Why the heck is that? Why are receptors for water-soluble hormones on the surface of the target cell? Yeah, because they can't get through the phospholipid bilayer, right? So these water-soluble hormones work through second messengers. Sometimes the effects are pretty quick because we can couple these to a cascade mechanism with different levels of amplification if it's a second messenger. Right, and of course there's an exception to the rule where steroid hormones bind to cytosolic receptors. There are some that bind to surface receptors on the cell, but they don't work through transcription. We call that the non-genomic action of lipid hormones. All right, so let's take a look at lipophilic hormones. We have some nice diagrams right here. Okay, so here we have a hormone, and it's bound to a carrier protein, because what can you tell me about this hormone right here? Why is it bound to a carrier protein in the plasma? Oh, let's look at this slide a little bit. I didn't describe what we're looking at. We're looking at blood right here, and then we're looking at a cell. So here's the cytosol, here's the nucleus, here's the cell membrane, right? And then here is just extracellular fluid or blood flowing through the body. And here we have a hormone bound to a carrier protein. And do you see a membrane receptor for this hormone right here? Do you see a receptor on the plasma membrane, or do you see a receptor in the cytoplasm? It's in the cytoplasm. So what can you tell me about this hormone right here? Is it lipophilic or lipophobic? Or a better way of saying that, is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Yeah, hydrophobic. Doesn't want to dissolve in water, right? So this is like a steroid hormone right here. And why does it need a carrier protein? Because it doesn't like to dissolve in plasma, right? So it binds to this little protein right here, acts like a detergent, and allows the blood to carry a certain concentration of this hormone because it doesn't like to dissolve in water. But it's always bouncing off the protein carrier, and then it associates and dissociates again. So there's an equilibrium between free hormone in the plasma and hormone that's on this carrier protein. Most will be on these carrier proteins, right? Then it dissociates every once in a while, and when it does, it can diffuse right through the plasma membrane. Do you agree with that? Yeah, because, and you should know why that is, right? Because the plasma membrane is lipid. It can diffuse into the cell, right? So here is a steroid hormone inside the cell. Here is the cytosolic receptor. We call this a nuclear receptor, or a nuclear hormone receptor right here, and there's a couple parts to it. Here is the receptor, and then here is the second part that can actually bind to DNA. So the hormone then binds to the receptor, it translocates into the nucleus, and then this element of the receptor can bind to DNA and then start some unwinding and can start transcription. So here is the transcript that will be produced. The messenger RNA comes out into the cytoplasm, and then translation can take place, producing this new protein. And that's going to be the response of this particular hormone right here. It's going to produce a special kind of protein that's going to change the metabolism of this cell. Okay, so I think that's all I need to say about that diagram. So nuclear hormone receptors serve as transcription factors, right, when they bind a hormone. Did I go forward or backwards? Backwards. All right, and that can activate transcription. All right, so all of these nuclear hormone receptors, there are many, many of them. So it constitutes a super family composed of a steroid family and thyroid family of hormones, because thyroid hormone is lipophilic, and which also includes vitamin D and retinoic acid. So these we don't really consider hormones, but these are lipid kinds of compounds, and we're going to see how they interact with hormones to to affect transcription. Okay. So here is that nuclear hormone receptor that could be floating in the cytoplasm or in the nucleoplasm. And here is the signaling compound that binds to the receptor. And so here is the ligand binding domain of the nuclear hormone receptor. Here is the DNA binding domain. And when the hormone binds to the receptor, then the DNA binding domain can actually bind to certain parts or segments of a DNA molecule. So here is a DNA molecule, and proximal to the target gene, which is on this segment of the DNA, there are binding sites for these nuclear hormone receptors. And so this is called the hormone response element. And notice that it has a dotted line right here. And so there are actually two sites. All right, so one site has what we call two half sites. So in order for transcription to take place, both of these half sites have to be occupied by a transcription factor. And in this particular case, right, we have two steroid hormones and two hormone receptor proteins binding to the two half sites, and then that will allow this gene to be transcribed. So this process where it requires two of these nuclear hormone receptors to bind to the hormone response element right here, this is what we call dimerization. Right? And if the ligand that's binding to the nuclear hormone receptor right here is the same, we call that homodimerization. If these two ligands right here are different, then we're going to call that heterodimerization. Right? But nonetheless, both of these sites have to be occupied in order for transcription to take place. Ooh, I did talk about this already. All right, let's look at the mechanism of action of thyroid hormone. All right, so thyroid hormone comes from the thyroid gland. It releases it's mostly T4 or thyroxine, about 90%. 10% is T3, which is what, triiodothreonine. T4 is bound in the blood to a carrier protein called thyroid binding globulin. Okay, because what can you tell me about thyroid hormone? Since it requires thyroid binding globulin. Doesn't like to dissolve in water, so it's hydrophobic, so it has to have a carrier protein. And remember, there's always an equilibrium between bound hormone and hormone that is free in the plasma, but it's low concentrations in the plasma because it doesn't like to be in plasma. Right? But that free amount that's dissociated from the carrier protein can enter the cell. They can just diffuse through the plasma membrane, and then T4 is converted into T3 inside the cell, and T3 is the active form of thyroid hormones. So T3 binds to a receptor protein located in the nucleus, right? And that is one step that you need to form a competent transcription factor. The other thing that is necessary, since dimerization has to happen in order for transcription to take place, right, there has to be heterodimerization taking place. So here is the hormone response unit that's responsible for binding T3, but the other partner doesn't need T3, it needs retinoic acid. Right, so retinoic acid, when it binds to its receptor, permits the transcription of this particular gene right here. So that's the permissive action of retinoic acid on the action of thyroid hormone inside cells. All right, so here is just a little scheme that shows that in order for T3 to have an effect, there also has to be retinoic acid, which is another hydrophobic compound in your body, but not considered a hormone. All right, and since these two substances are different, we call that, what kind of dimer is this? What kind of dimer is this right here? Heterodimer, that's right. So there's a big difference between heterodimer and homodimer in terms of transcription factors. All right, so that's for hydrophilic kinds of signaling molecules. All right, let's turn our attention to hormones that are hydrophilic. And so these can't get through the cell membrane, so these have extracellular receptors, so water-soluble hormones. use cell surface receptors because they can't pass through the cell membrane. And we learned about some neurotransmitters that don't work through second messengers. They just work by opening up ion channels. But some neurotransmitters do work through G-protein coupled receptors, which increase second messengers inside the cell. All right, and hormones don't directly open up ion channels. They work through second messengers inside the cell. All right, so hormones are mediated, the actions of these hormones are mediated by second messengers. Where do you always find a second messenger? Inside the cell. Where do you find a hydrophilic hormone? Always. Outside the cell. That's the first messenger. Okay. All right, so hormone is extracellular signal, always outside. The second messenger then implements that signal, okay, on the inside of the cell due to binding of the hormone on an extracellular receptor. All right, so here we see a nice phospholipid bilayer. Here's a hormone, and it can't get through the bilayer. So what kind of hormone is this right here? That's a hydrophilic, right? So that's hydrophilic kinds of hormones are polypeptide or protein modified by glucose hormones. All right, so it binds to receptors. So here's the receptor protein, but it's G-coupled protein receptor. Here's the G-protein right here. When the hormone binds, the G-protein dissociates, alpha unit can float around inside the membrane, and it can bump into another protein that's embedded in the membrane. In this particular case, adenylate cyclase. And what can adenylate cyclase do? It can break ATP down into cyclic AMP, which is a special form of monophosphate, adenosine monophosphate. It's actually a ring structure, so it has a special shape. It's used as a second messenger inside the cell. All right, so adenylate cyclase makes cyclic AMP. So then there's a buildup of cyclic AMP inside the cell because of binding of this hormone. So we have one hormone right here. How many cyclic AMPs are produced when adenylate cyclase becomes activated? Just one? Many, right? Because enzymes are not changed by the reaction. Right, so as long as this alpha unit is bound to adenylate cyclase, it will become active and will catalyze that reaction over and over and over and over and over again. Cyclic AMP, then, is a second messenger. It can bounce into, diffuse over, and bounce into a protein, which is normally inactive. All right, and this is an enzyme and a kinase. What does a kinase do? It runs around phosphorylating other kinds of things inside the cell and maybe some other kinds of proteins, right? And in the absence of cyclic AMP, there is a subunit to this enzyme that inhibits the activity of this enzyme. But once cyclic AMP is there, then it causes dissociation of this inhibitory subunit. So cyclic AMP and the subunit bind together, come over here, which leaves what? The protein kinase in an active form. So it runs around inside the cell, phosphorylating different kinds of enzymes, and that's like poking you in the side. When you get phosphorylated, if you're an enzyme, what are you going to do? You're going to change conformation, right, which can change the active site. And depending on how the active site is changed, when that enzyme goes through a conformation change, it can either activate or inactivate the enzyme, depending on how that active site changes. Right, so then these enzymes will change the metabolism inside the cell right here. All right, so this is adenylate cyclase coupled mechanism that produces cyclic AMP as a second messenger through this G-protein coupled receptor for a water-soluble hormone. And we talked about this already. Let's see if we can relate this to the vision system a little bit. Okay, vision requires a cyclic compound, but not cyclic AMP. Okay, what nucleotide for rod cell did we look at specifically? Yeah, GTP gets converted into cyclic GMP. All right, and that was guanylate cyclase. And part of that control mechanism was, how do you get rid of cyclic GMP? There was an enzyme that destroys cyclic GMP, and it's the same enzyme that will destroy cyclic AMP. And that is a phosphodiesterase. So maybe just jot that down on your slide someplace. Phosphodiesterase then will reduce cyclic AMP and get the cell back to a resting state. Okay. Oh, here it is on this slide. All right, so this effect of this hormone then can be deactivated when cyclic AMP is destroyed by phosphodiesterase. All right, so that's what produces the balance. It's a balance between adenylate cyclase activity and the normal of activity of phosphodiesterase inside the cell. Right, and the cell determines the balance by adjusting the activity of adenylate cyclase to produce these effects right here. Okay, there's another mechanism, phospholipase C mechanism. And phospholipase C is, what the heck is phospholipase? Okay, I see it has something to do with phosphorylation. And what about lipase? What can you tell me about lipase? It breaks down lipids, okay? Now, do you see any lipids anywhere on this diagram? Where's a nice precursor, or where's a good substrate for phospholipase C? Yeah, in the membrane. Look at all these phospholipids right here. All right, so these lipids are already phosphorylated, so the building block of the membrane is actually the substrate for this particular enzyme, phospholipase C. And there are other different phospholipases in your body, and you could probably tell me the names of a couple of them, but we're not talking about them right now. But what are some other phospholipases? Like phospholipase A, which is probably the first one. Phospholipase B was probably the second one somebody discovered, right? And then somebody found another one, a third one, and guess what we would call that? Phospholipase C, okay? Okay. And phospholipase C is embedded in the membrane, surrounded by the substrate, but it's not active all the time, which is good because then this membrane would dissolve away. All right, but when the receptor here binds a hormone and activates the G protein, those activated G proteins just diffuse around inside the cell, bump into phospholipase C, all right, and activates it. Now, what can you tell? What's the nature of this phospholipase right here? Phospholipase C, is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's a hydrophobic protein because it's embedded in the membrane. Okay? Yep. So that's kind of a little dirty trick I just played on you guys. So you have like two major worlds inside your body. One is water world inside the cell, and the other is lipid world. And we're just beginning to understand how important this lipid world is in terms of controlling things inside your body. Okay? So this lipid world, the structure of it, makes the cell membrane. Okay, but this membrane is also a substrate for important control mechanisms that take place in your body. And even inside the plasma membrane, there are proteins that can only exist in this lipid world right here that can produce these important second messengers, all right, namely inositol-3-phosphate. But you don't have to know the name of this thing, probably just the diagram, IP3. We just call that IP3, is a second messenger similar to cyclic AMP. Then IP3 will diffuse around in the cytoplasm and will bump into this endoplasmic reticulum right here, okay, and will cause calcium channels to open up, and then calcium floods the inside of the cell, so calcium is actually another second messenger that's going to change activity inside the cell. All right, so what kind of endoplasmic reticulum does this look like to you? That's smooth, right? So hopefully I mentioned at the beginning of the class, smooth ER. You're going to remember two things about smooth ER should be what? Lipid synthesis and calcium storage, because calcium should be at very low, almost zero concentration in the resting cell, in the cytosol, right? You find it high concentration in smooth ER or outside of the cell, extracellular, but not inside the cell, because it's a second messenger. If it was at a high concentration all the time inside the cell, it couldn't be used as a messenger to control anything. All right, so here is another important enzyme. Besides adenylate cyclase producing cyclic AMP, there's phospholipase C that produces IP3, but there's also another compound that it produces, and that is diacylglycerol, and that we're just going to call DAG. Okay, and that can cause opening of calcium channels, maybe calcium channels in the plasma membrane or calcium channels in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, opening up and increasing calcium inside the cytoplasm. Well, what does calcium do? I think we talked about this already a little bit. Maybe not. Yeah, I think I mentioned this. There's a protein in the cytoplasm that binds calcium. It's called calmodulin. All right, so calcium diffuses into the, not just cytoplasm, but you might want to say cytosol, right, the fluid part of the cytoplasm, activates calmodulin. So calcium binds to calmodulin, right, and then this form right here, calmodulin bound to calcium, can activate a protein kinase. It can turn a protein kinase on. And what's the job of this protein kinase? It's running around phosphorylating different enzymes. And again, that's like poking you in the side. What happens to you and a friend pokes you in the side? You change conformation, right, which then might change the active site on these enzymes to either activate them or inactivate various kinds of enzymes. And when you change the activity of an enzyme inside of a cell, you change the metabolism of that cell. And we're going to get to some specific examples, right now, as a matter of fact. All right, so all that was fairly abstract. Here's a really good example. Okay, you could probably relate to this. And it has to do glucose control, right? Glucose concentration in your blood. Do you have an intuitive sense that that's pretty important? Yeah, because glucose is an important energy molecule. Mitochondria can use it to make ATP, to run organs. And there's some organs that require a lot of ATP, like your brain. How long can your brain function without your brain cells making ATP? About 2 or 3 seconds, right? And then when does your brain die when it can't make ATP? Yeah, like 2 to 3 minutes, right? So that's very important. So glucose is an important substrate to have available to make ATP. All right, so here is a hormone, epinephrine, for instance, from the adrenal medulla, when it's secreted from the adrenal medulla. Where does it go when it's secreted from the adrenal medulla? Everywhere. It goes into your blood, right? It goes everywhere, including the liver right here, right? And we learned something about glycogenesis. What's glycogenesis? Glycogenesis. It's making glycogen from glucose. So the liver is an important storage form of glucose, right, in the form of glycogen. All right, so here's a liver cell, and it's loaded with glycogen. But don't forget, glycogen is really glucose that's stored in your body for when you're fasting, for instance. All right, well, how does the liver know to break this glycogen down to increase glucose in your blood when blood glucose starts to decrease? All right, one of the hormones that affects this is epinephrine that is maybe stimulated, is released during the fight or flight response. All right, so you have epinephrine in the blood, and it's going to bind to surface receptors because it's a hydrophilic hormone. And in this particular case, right, that's going to activate adenylate cyclase. We just saw by working through a G-coupled protein mechanism, it activates adenylate cyclase. Right, so you have ATP being converted into cyclic AMP, and cyclic AMP will activate a protein kinase, and this protein kinase right here is going to snip off a glucose molecule from glycogen, and what does a kinase do? It phosphorylates, so now you have glucose 1-phosphate right here, right? So that's a nice phosphorylation step. And then there's another enzyme that rearranges that phosphate into glucose 6-phosphate, and then there's another enzyme that removes this phosphate, right? It has to be this glucose has to be phosphorylated to get it released from glycogen. And then in order for the liver cell to release this glucose into the blood, this phosphate has to be taken off. So what did we call that enzyme that takes this phosphate off of glucose to make it just a regular old glucose that can go back into the blood? Yeah, glucose, that's a phosphatase. Glucose phosphatase, okay? And then that increases blood glucose levels. All right, so this is one mechanism that works through adenylate cyclase and cyclic AMP, and that's due to a beta-adrenergic receptor, but there are also alpha-adrenergic receptors on liver cells that can bind epinephrine. And when they bind epinephrine, that causes release of calcium into the cytosol. There could be extracellular calcium or calcium where else? Where else do we find calcium inside the cell? Smooth endoplasmic reticulum, then that increase in calcium will bind to calmodulin. Calmodulin will increase the activity of a protein kinase, which then will chop a glucose off of glycogen and phosphorylate it, which eventually will, right, that glucose will end up in the blood. All right, so here's a really good specific example of those second messenger systems. All right, so beta adrenergic work through cyclic AMP. I think this is a review. And alpha adrenergic work through calcium as a second messenger. Okay, that was a slide from, I think, the autonomic nervous system. Okay, here is another messenger system. And this is a tyrosine kinase second messenger system. There are a number of hormones that work through these, but I think the first one that was worked out was for insulin. Right? Insulin does not enter the cell, but if the receptor is working properly and if insulin is present, it allows something else to enter the cell. What does insulin allow to enter the cell? What molecule can enter a cell when insulin is present? Glucose, that's right. And in many cells, without an insulin signal, glucose can't enter a cell. What's going to happen to those cells? They're going to starve to death, right? Terrible condition. Okay, so let's look at this because it's so important. So a tyrosine kinase, right, is a dimer. It has two proteins that don't associate with each other. They're close by in the membrane, all right? And when there is insulin, there is a dimerization process that takes place. These two dimers come together into the active site, and it holds this insulin signal. All right, and so now it changes the conformation of this protein, and notice this protein goes all the way through the membrane. It's a transmembrane protein, and it activates an ATPase on the tip of this receptor. And so the receptor actually becomes phosphorylated when it binds an insulin molecule. So two ATPs are expended. The receptor enzyme becomes phosphorylated and activated when that happens. And when other proteins that bump into this receptor right here that is now activated, right, can then phosphorylate tyrosine residues or amino acids in that particular protein. So here is a protein that's not phosphorylated. It bumps into the activated tyrosine kinase receptor. We can see it's activated because it's phosphorylated. Then this protein can become phosphorylated at the positions where there are tyrosine amino acids. All right, and when that tyrosine becomes phosphorylated, what happens to the shape of this protein right here? It changes shape. And what does that really mean, especially in this class? If you change the shape of something, what do you change? The function. You change the activity of this protein right here. All right, now all the steps are not clearly understood, but what did we say insulin allows? The entrance into the cell of glucose. All right, so hopefully that's going to be on our next slide right here. But anyway, when this protein becomes phosphorylated, there's a whole bunch of different effects, a cascade of effects, and then glucose is taken up, okay, by the cell for its anabolic purposes. Next slide. Okay, I talked about both of those. This is the one I wanted to get to. All right, so here we have a cell. See a nice plasma membrane right here. And remember, glucose is a hydrophilic compound. Like if you take glucose, put it in your coffee in the morning, what does it do? Fall to the bottom and just sit there all day long? No, it dissolves very nicely, right? Okay, so glucose cannot get through this membrane right here because it's way too hydrophilic. So there has to be a transporter that allows glucose to enter the cell. Even though there's high glucose on the outside of the cell and low glucose on the inside, glucose wants to get in, right? But it can't because of the nature of the membrane right here. It needs a transporter. And the transporters that allow that are what we call the GLUT4 transporters. So glucose can diffuse into the active site within the membrane of this GLUT4 transporter, but the GLUT4 transporter is open to the outside of the cell at one time or the inside of the cell at one time, but not open to both at any time. It's open to one side or the other. In this particular case, the transporter is open to the extracellular side. Glucose diffuses in, binds to an active site, and when it does, that's like what? Poking you in the side. The protein is going to change conformation so that now it's closed to the outside and opens to the inside so glucose can move inside the cell. What kind of transport is that? So you have glucose going from high concentration to low, but it's regulated. It is what kind of motion? Okay. Yeah, it's carrier-mediated transport, but is it active or passive? Okay. From high to low is passive. It's just diffusion, right? Because there is energy in the gradient of glucose. So that energy can be used to actually transport glucose inside the cell. ATP. Do you see ATP anywhere here? Nope. Okay. I don't see a concentration of another ion. So it's not any kind of coupled transport, active transport. It's not secondary active transport, not primary active transport. It is just simple diffusion, but since it requires this transporter right here, we call that facilitated diffusion is the correct term. It's probably rolling around in your mind someplace. Facilitated diffusion. Okay. All right, so how does glucose get inside the cell? Well, we need an insulin signal for the following reason. Here's that tyrosine kinase that's activated with insulin. It becomes phosphorylated, which then phosphorylates other kinds of compounds inside the cell. And these compounds that are phosphorylated then can take endosomes. These are vesicles contained within inside the cell that are loaded with GLUT4 transporters. But do these GLUT4 transporters do anything for the cell if they're sitting in an endosome inside the cell? They're inactive, basically, right? They can't transport glucose anywhere. But nonetheless, these transporters are in reserve as a reservoir. They can be inserted into the plasma membrane. Just hop a ride on a microtubule system. This vesicle moves over to the plasma membrane, fuses with the plasma membrane, and now you have these inactive GLUT4 transporters in the plasma membrane, which can then perform their merry function by letting glucose enter the cell. And this process can happen very rapidly. All right, so this endosome system is very fancy, because if the insulin signal worked through a genomic action, how long would it take for this cell to take glucose up? Yeah, maybe a half hour, hour, something like that, and you might be in a coma by that period of time, right? So this is a very fast way that insulin can work on this particular cell. And then there's always a mechanism that's taking these transporters out of the membrane and putting it back into these endosomes, and so that's the balance right here. So there are different kinds of dysregulation of glucose metabolism because of insulin. There are some kinds of diabetes where a person does not make insulin, okay? And so there's no insulin to bind to this receptor, so the GLUT4 transporters don't get put into the membrane. But there are other forms of diabetes where the insulin is at normal levels, but there's something wrong with the receptor. Maybe the cell isn't making receptors. All right, that's one form. Another form is maybe the tyrosine kinase receptor is working fine, but some of these signaling molecules are misbehaving in the cell so that this translocation process is not taking place. That's another form of diabetes. Okay, so it's important to know what kind of diabetes before you can treat it, because you can't treat somebody with a type 2 diabetes, for instance, with insulin, because it won't affect these other mechanisms that are taking place where inside the cell, not the pancreas, which releases insulin, for instance. Okay, so that's a pretty cool mechanism. All right, pituitary gland. Talked about pituitary a little bit in, Here, pass that around really fast. Scribble your name down there really fast. Pass it around. Sign in sheet. I forgot. Oops. Okay, don't forget. A test when? Yeah, so 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks from today, if anybody came in late. All right, so here's the pituitary gland, and you're probably pretty familiar with where it is. Here's part of the diencephalon, namely the hypothalamus. Here's that ventricle within the diencephalon, and that is the third ventricle. So you have walls of the third ventricle that make up the hypothalamus. And then here's the pituitary. What's another name for pituitary? It's called hypophysis below the hypothalamus, right? So here's hypothalamus, here's the hypophysis or pituitary. And then here's the connection between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland. We don't get into the distinctions of these different groups too much. Okay, but the pituitary gland has two main regions. There's an anterior region and a posterior. And the posterior region right here is really a continuation of the central nervous system. It's part of the brain. The anterior pituitary is really from an epithelial origin. So it's really glandular tissue. Posterior is really neuronal tissue. The anterior part is glandular tissue. Nonetheless, the whole pituitary is controlled by the hypothalamus. The anterior pituitary, since it's derived from epithelium, produces its own hormones, but it's controlled by other hormones from the hypothalamus. The posterior pituitary right here, right, just stores hormones and releases hormones when action potentials come down a track through the infundibulum. All right, so the mode of regulation is pretty different between the anterior and posterior pituitary. Let's look in particular at the posterior pituitary. It releases two hormones, all right, and that is antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin. Another name for antidiuretic hormone is vasopressin. It has a tendency to increase blood pressure. Sometimes it can cause contraction of smooth muscle. So if you have a water balloon and you squeeze down on a water balloon, what happens to the pressure inside that water balloon? Go up or go down? It goes up, that's right. So vasopressin can cause contraction of smooth muscle that causes constriction, vasoconstriction. That will increase blood pressure. But vasopressin, another name for it, is antidiuretic hormone. What does a diuretic make you do? Makes you urinate. So an antidiuretic hormone prevents you from urinating, or to some degree prevents you from urinating. It prevents you from losing water, so you maintain water. Right? That also increases blood pressure. So for instance, if you have a tire that's low on pressure, do you take air out or do you put air in? You put air in. Same for your body. If your blood pressure is low, you put fluid in. If your blood pressure is too high, what can you do to reduce it? Take blood volume out, okay? Just like filling up a tire. All right, so, and then we have oxytocin. Oxytocin stimulates some smooth muscles to contract, particularly of the uterus during parturition, and smooth muscle of the breast during nursing. We call that the milk letdown reflex, all right? Is produced by oxytocin from the posterior pituitary. Here we have nuclei in the hypothalamus. We've got the paraventricular, which means they're what, on either side of the third ventricle. Supraoptic nucleus just means that it's a nucleus or a group of nerve cell bodies that is just superior to the optic chiasma right here, right, in the hypothalamus. It has long axons, right, and these are myelinated axons that move through the infundibulum, and then the axon terminus is in the posterior pituitary. What do we call a bunch of myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system? A tract, that's right. So here we have the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, right? It's just a tract between the hypothalamus and the hypophysis, which is the pituitary gland. Okay, pretty wordy. But here it is. So action potentials come down these axons, and when it reaches these axon termini, then depending on where the axons originated, it will release either antidiuretic hormone or oxytocin. And these are hormones. So where do they go then? They're picked up by a capillary and delivered everywhere in your body. Okay. The action is a little bit different on the anterior pituitary because this is glandular tissue. It makes its own hormones right here in the anterior pituitary. But it still receives signals from the hypothalamus. There are neurons within the hypothalamus. When they receive proper input, action potential comes down to the axon terminus, and they will release hormones. All right, and where does a hormone have to go? Into the blood. So there's a capillary bed right in this region, okay, of the hypothalamus, and they absorb these hormones that we call releasing hormones or releasing factors. And then these releasing factors will be delivered to the anterior pituitary directly. They won't go everywhere in the body because this is a special portal system. What the heck is a portal system? I think in anatomy you looked at a couple portal systems. The usual circulation is you have a heart and then a blood vessel. What's the name of a blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart? An artery. That artery goes to a capillary that allows for exchange, and then blood goes back to the heart. What do we call a blood vessel that takes blood back to the heart? A vein. But in a portal system, you don't have one capillary, you have two, back to back. You've got an artery taking blood away from the heart to capillary bed number one, then another blood vessel, we call a portal blood vessel, goes to a second capillary, and then blood goes back to the heart via vein. So portal systems are special delivery systems. So this hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. Is it on your slide right here? I don't know if you have to know that or not. Maybe there's a question at the end of the book. All right, here's the portal system. Capillary bed number one is in the median eminence, picks up releasing hormones from the hypothalamus, delivers them directly to the, which part of the pituitary? The anterior pituitary. You got to have that on the tip of your tongue. I think that's really important. All right, and here's another capillary bed. Remember, exchange can take place in the capillary bed. So what about those releasing hormones? Where do they go? From the blood to these tissues right here. And it's going to change the activity of the glandular tissue of the anterior pituitary that can inhibit or excite the release of other hormones from the anterior pituitary. All right, so here are the anterior pituitary hormones then, which are released from the glandular tissue of the anterior pituitary, go everywhere in the body and can have effects everywhere in the body as long as those parts of the body have what? A receptor, right? Okay, so let's look, here's a good exam figure. Let's look at some of these, what we call trophic hormones from the anterior pituitary. There are six of them, okay? And some of them will have an effect on the breast, because what does the breast have? Receptors for this particular hormone that we call prolactin. All right, some of the hormones will have an effect on the thyroid, because the thyroid has a receptor for thyroid-stimulating hormone. Okay, so the anterior pituitary can release these six hormones. Prolactin. Prolactin goes to the breast, and prolactin causes development of glandular tissue of the breast so that it can produce milk. All right, so that glandular tissue has to mature in order for this breast to produce milk. But prolactin is not necessary for milk letdown. Even though the glandular tissue is mature and can't produce milk, it won't eject it from the breast. We just talked about a hormone that's responsible for that. And that is oxytocin from the posterior pituitary. So two separate things. All right, so during pregnancy, actually during gestation, okay, prolactin is released and that causes maturation of the glandular tissue of the breast. So that when there's a proper signal, oxytocin from the posterior pituitary, there can be a milk letdown reflex or ejection of milk from the breast. All right, so that's the job of prolactin. The anterior pituitary also releases growth hormone, which stimulates the growth of bone and adipose and muscle tissue everywhere in your body. So that's necessary for development, and even some amounts are necessary for maintenance as well. The thyroid gland is designed to release thyroid hormone like T3 and T4, but the thyroid gland is maintained by activity from the anterior pituitary, and that activity is thyroid stimulating hormone. So thyroid stimulating hormone causes the thyroid gland to grow, just like these other trophic hormones did on their respective organs, and also then causes the release of T3 and T4 from the thyroid gland. Okay, so it produces growth as well as release. Adrenal corticotropic hormone from the anterior pituitary causes the growth and maintenance of the adrenal cortex, not the adrenal medulla, but the adrenal cortex, and also causes the release of adrenal cortical hormones like cortisol was a good example that we used previously. And then we have two hormones as a class. We call them gonadotropins, right? And they're FSH and LH. They're called gonadotropins because they have effects on the gonads. And the two kinds of gonads are ovaries and testes, whether female or male. And it has various effects on these two different organs. But basically, FSH promotes the production of gametes. A gamete is a sex cell. And females produce eggs, males produce sperm, okay? And then LH has different effects. We're going to talk about this when we get to the very last chapter in this class. But LH produces or induces ovulation of an egg from a follicle in an ovary right here. So it produces ovulation in females. LH is responsible for the secretion of testosterone. Right, and the secretion of estrogen and progesterone in the ovary is a little bit more complicated and involves some other kinds of things that are happening throughout the ovarian and menstrual cycle that we'll have to look at a little bit later. So these things right here are what we call gonadotropins. All right, so right after spring break, we'll finish up this chapter because I want to talk about specifically the interaction of the hypothalamus that causes release of TSH or causes the release of ACTH. It's pretty simple, but you got to memorize this slide, okay, over spring break. It's not too bad. It's easy. Thank you.